helping brands maximize the value of their sponsorships and create more engaging experiences. This is the Market Share Sports Podcast.
Welcome to the Market Share Sports Podcast. Really excited. Today we have Mike Mooney joining us in studio. Had a great conversation on some things going on in NASCAR now, and of course what he's working on in the future. Mike is a 25-year veteran in the marketing side of the motorsports industry. He's worked with some great brands like Mercedes-Benz, Tylenol, Walmart, Eli Lilly, Bacardi, Kellogg, and more. He's got a new book coming out soon, Reputation Shift. I think you'll enjoy hearing about it and what he's doing today currently with brand building and positioning. Enjoy our conversation with Mike Mooney. Hey, welcome to the Market Share Sports Podcast. We're here with Mike Mooney. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Oh, pleasure to be here. Thanks, Jim.
Hey, man. Listen, so we decided we're going to start this podcast. You're sitting down with us today. I'm going to give you the opportunity to tell us, if you could sit down with anybody alive today for an interview, who would that be?
For an interview?
Or just to sit down and have
a conversation.
Wow.
You know, I'm going to go, and I know this is kind of a sports theme perhaps, but I'm going with the Dalai Lama.
Wow, there you go.
What do you think?
It's a good choice.
What do you think? I think you kind of get some inspiration, a little perspective, okay. Right? Ask some questions, maybe get some answers or more questions to your questions.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, you very well be.
Right?
Good answer.
Right.
I think it's always insightful. I know it's kind of, then you start thinking, wait a minute, actually, maybe I could have gone here too, or I could have done this, but that's pretty high standard. That's pretty good.
Well, you know, and now there are like three or four popping in, but I try to go with the gut, and that was the first one that popped in my head. So I'm sticking with the llama. He's a big hitter. It's a big hitter, the llama.
That is a big hitter. You got aspirational goals. I like it. So, hey, Mike, tell us, we're going to talk about a lot of different things today, sports marketing related, and kind of what you're doing today. Give the audience a background. How'd you get to where you are today? You've been doing motorsports for about 25 years.
Yeah. It's funny, man. I think about that and think about how I got into it and where I started with a guy by the name of Tom Cotter, who had an agency years back called Cotter Group. And when I first started with Tom, it was to manage their warehouse and stuff press kits and make copies, change air filters, all for $16,000 a year. And I couldn't have been happier. Right. But it was one of those things where you hear about those phrases, happy and humble. Right. And I was happy. I was humble. And I wanted to learn. And through that time with Tom on the PR side, I was able to really learn storytelling and how to connect, you know, brands through athletes to fans. And great experience there. And then they moved up, you know, through my career to work on the marketing side of the house for several years on the agencies, and have worked for the brands for Nextel when they took over the series sponsorship for Winston back in 2003.
You were working for Nextel?
I was, yeah. I came over to run the marketing communications program. So really the launch and the strategy for the messaging and you know, with product launches. It was amazing. I can't tell you where those first 3.5 years went, right? Because we were on the road, and that was when cell phones were becoming way more pervasive, you know, and you were always on, much like we are today, but, you know, we're just learning that then.
And you guys added the whole component now, so two-way radio, so you really were always on.
Always. Yeah, the direct connect back then, right? Yeah. That was a big deal. It was a big deal. So had the opportunity to work on the brand side for several years, and most recently was with Roush Fenway Racing. You know, great organization. So spent the last 5 years with them, you know, on the property side.
You did
which
5 years,
and
wow.
Flies, man.
That did fly, no doubt about it. Now, you skipped over in there. You also spent some time on the agency side, which I think is important for the discussion here. You were with Millsport.
Yeah, the marketing arm. They were bought by them. So the marketing arm is based out of Dallas. Great, great agency. Really got to work with some amazing brands there, running programs for Walmart, Tylenol, Sunoco, Lowe's, Pepsi, right? So just a great experience on learning the strategy, the insights, how important insights and emotion played into, you know, the activation plans that we were putting together through sports, entertainment, you know, retailtainment, right? The world that you're in.
Right. Well, listen, I think that's, and I think that's good for people to hear. I think young people who are looking to get into the business, you know, everybody wants to run a team. Everybody wants to be, we always say everybody wants to be a general manager of an NFL team.
Right.
But it is kind of fun when you
you start looking at people who were in different positions and where they've come in their careers and how they got started, stuffing kits in a warehouse, managing a warehouse,
man,
to doing brand strategy for a brand, to managing $100 million in sponsorships with Roush Fenway Racing at the highest level in NASCAR. I mean, so it's just kind of a fun journey to hear.
Well, you know, and I'll tell you, I think when I look back, it's really just been about being curious and just wanting to learn and trying to find other avenues to learn new ways of connecting brands. It's really about bringing them to life. That's really what we're trying to do, right? And it's finding that passion point, which seems to be, I want to say it's an overused phrase, but it really is about finding the passion for that consumer and how do we connect with them credibly and authentically and in a relevant way, right? So again, that's the storytelling in my opinion.
Yeah. Listen, and you and I haven't done a lot together, haven't spent a lot of time together, but enough time to know we have a pretty similar path and pretty similar focus on our sports careers, where it is all about, we've been lucky to be in positions where we've had the opportunity to, we've done a lot of NASCAR, mm-hmm. but really sports agnostic, that whole idea of how do you take a sports property, connect it for a brand and leverage it to drive sales.
Right.
At the end of the day, move the needle on measurable business results for those sponsors.
That's it. I mean, you look at sports. Sports is a performance-based, you know, arena, right? If you're not winning, people are going to be questioning the value of what they're investing, much like what's happening in the marketplace at retail, for that matter. If you're not selling more products, you're not winning.
Right.
It'll be looked at differently. So really, yeah, it is. I've always looked at sport as being the vehicle, right, that is going to be able to connect that brand to the consumer, because they're always looking. I mean, today's marketplace, it is so cluttered, Jim. You know that. You know, I mean, that's what we live in. So you're constantly striving to find ways to cut through that clutter.
Yeah. And we always say the path to purchase leads mm-hmm. through passionate experiences.
Yeah.
And so typically any kind of behavior change, I mean, it kind of comes through something that you're passionate about.
Right.
And so it may be tying it to a passionate, some of the sport you're passionate about, a musician you're passionate about, mm-hmm. You follow their behavior or whatever, and how do you leverage that? Maybe a bad doctor report that causes behavior.
Right.
But at some point, if we're going to really move the needle and drive business, our ability to tap into that passion of fans or whatever the consumers, really passionate about, how do we connect the brand to it?
Yeah.
And do that. And you guys have done a good job at that.
Well, man, you have to, out of necessity. Mm-hmm. You have to, because you're competing with so many other teams and properties for the sponsorship dollar, right? It's not just, you know, it starts with, while the end result is really connecting the brand to the consumer, for the property or the agency, it's really about trying to get the dollars to be able to fund the program,
right,
in the first place. And we're competing with so many other properties now. It's amazing to me. I read a statistic recently that said that in 2018, that there will be more than $1 billion invested in college sports sponsorships. Makes sense, right? As pervasive as it is. Read another report saying that for the first time in 2018, there will be $1 billion spent in arts sponsorships, right? Never have thought that.
Right.
But it just shows you that the dollars are being spread across multiple platforms. I remember a meeting I was in a few years back with a brand manager that we were pitching for a race sponsorship. And when I asked him, you know, okay, so, you know, who are we up against? I'm just curious, you know, are the other teams, you know, what's our competition look like? And ironically, it wasn't any other teams in NASCAR. He said, it's between you and the Westminster Kennel Club.
Wow.
The dog show.
Wow.
Right? So I'm scratching my head going, wait a minute, you were competing with dogs, you know, but that's the choices that brand managers have today is wider than it's ever been.
Yeah. When we talk about it in retail, we always talk about share of stomach, right?
Yeah.
Or CPG space, right?
Yep.
So it's like, and where our grocery retailers used to compete with just grocery retailers.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're competing with Amazon. Now you're competing with, in the prepared food space, we're competing with McDonald's. We're competing with Chick-fil-A. It's,
absolutely.
You know, everybody's, you're only going to eat a certain number of times a day. Where am I going to get it from? And yeah. and so, yeah, brands definitely have a lot of options for the money, and it is imperative. And you guys at Roush Fenway, I think you did a good job in your time there of positioning yourself to be a good partner for brands, trying to focus on their best interests and how they leverage the property. And so that speaks well.
Well, that was, again, you know, somewhat born out of necessity. Right. When you look at it, you know, it's no secret that over the past several years, the on-track performance for the team was not where we had wanted it to be by our own standards, by Jack Roush's standards. So as our teams were, our competition team was working to get that, you know, ship turned around and where it needed to be, we also recognized on the business side that we had to fundamentally shift the way that we worked with partners. You know, historically, teams have taken more of a transactional approach, you know, to the sponsorships. So thank you for the sponsor dollars. Here's the driver. Here's your activation assets. We'll see in Daytona. Whereas it really has to be relational, which is about being an active partner of understanding what do you need and how can we help you create this vision for how your assets can come to life. Let's not put the heavy lifting or burden on you. Let us be a partner in that.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, let's talk about NASCAR. You did. Yep. You recently left Roush Fenway back at the beginning of the year, and we're going to talk about what you're doing now here. But give me your take, because you had a couple of young drivers over there. Yep. NASCAR's got this young driver movement going on right mm-hmm. now. Give me your take mm-hmm. on that. Why should a brand be excited about it? Why should teams be excited about what's going on?
Yeah. I mean,
or should they? I'll give you that option too.
The out? no, I would say that it is exciting. You know, I think as you're seeing some of the older drivers retiring, you know, and moving on, it truly is opening the door for not only younger drivers to come in, but what the beauty of it is, and the beauty of sport, is that it allows us to tell stories. It allows these voices to really come to life. And I think that right now in the sport, there's a lot of excitement in terms of what these younger drivers can bring. Now, I would say that it could be exciting for teams, certainly, because it's the opportunity to brand and shape and develop, right, this next generation mm-hmm. of driver and how they can connect with fans. And you're seeing with, you know, Kyle Larson's done a great job over the past couple of years with that, you know. Right. So that's a great opportunity. I think the other good opportunity is on the sponsor side, quite honestly, because from an investment standpoint, you've got young drivers that are still proving themselves, right? That are going to come more than likely at a lower investment price point than some of these veterans did. So, you know, I think it's going to be a little challenging for the teams to have to figure out the pricing model on that, but also, you know, then getting a brand to step in and take a chance on a young driver. You know, maybe it is the next Jimmy Johnson. You don't know. Right. You don't know, but there's that opportunity there. And man, I'll tell you, what's coming up through the Xfinity series right now, you know, and then you're seeing them push into Cup. It's a great time.
It is a good time. I agree with you. And I think it's good from a racing product standpoint. Man, these guys are running every lap with their tongue hanging out. They're trying to make a name for themselves. They're proving that, hey, I want to be up front. They're challenging mm-hmm. some of the norms of, you know, what other drivers had kind of maybe fallen into, that this is what a driver does, is there whatever,
right.
either strategy-wise on the track or here's how we conduct ourselves off the track. These guys are different. I love what Ryan Blaney's doing on social media.
Absolutely, yes.
Really catching his personality. Chase Elliott obviously has got a good following. Bubba Wallace, I really love what he showed a lot of grit in the offseason on taking matters into his own hands, on trying to find sponsorships. Some things he did with Domino's Pizza I
Absolutely.
Think were phenomenal.
Yep.
I think that you got young talent like Eric Jones coming along, who is you know, finding his way, and we're really figuring out how to show his personality, but performing on the track amazingly. Daniel Suarez, we got doing well. And so you start looking down, you go, man, this is a good time for the sport. It really does kind of change a lot of different things. I always said, one of the things, whenever we're introducing people to racing, we always talk about the funnel, right? Mm, so on any right. given weekend, 1,500 guys play in the NFL.
Right.
Right. Yeah, and there's, in baseball, there's, I don't know, what is it, 750 guys on a team any given night in MLB, and in basketball, NBA, there's 450 guys on football teams. And so anybody who's ever played a stick and ball sport, you know how hard it is to make it to those next levels.
Absolutely.
But, man, you look at 40 spots to drive on Sunday.
Yeah.
And for so many years, those guys didn't have to get out of the seat. So you could drive for 25 years.
Absolutely, you could.
Yeah, and so, man, now we're getting used to this whole idea of maybe there'll be quicker turnover, and that's going to, I think that's the future of the sport. I think you'll see more guys retiring in their 30s and more young talent coming in. There's a lot of wasted talent. I hate to say wasted talent, but there's a lot of talent who showed up and mm-hmm. just could not get a seat and missed their opportunities in the past.
Yeah.
And so, yep. Good time.
Well, no, it is. And you've got drivers that understand the power and how to use social media to connect in new ways. Now, what we've got to make sure of, though, and this is something that's incumbent upon the teams, the driver managers, whoever they may be, is that, you know, these young drivers still need to be ambassadors. They need to recognize that they have to be present. They have to be engaged with their sponsors, with their fans. I mean, I've sat in meetings with some of these drivers where you have a sponsor and there you're talking and they're scrolling through their Twitter feed.
Yeah,
you know, and you're I'm about to come out of my chair, you know, because I'm like, oh, what are you doing? But it, for them, it's just second nature. Yeah. It's not like they're doing it on purpose or they're not involved or they're not interested. It's just behaviorally what they do. So we'd find ourselves sometimes talking to the young guys before meetings saying, listen, put your phone in your pocket, right? Or let me hold on to it because right now for the next hour or the next 45 minutes or however much time it is with this partner or in this environment, that is the single most important thing you have in your life right now.
Yeah, be present.
Be present, yeah. Right? Because they're growing up in a world where being present is I'm on four different social media platforms in 20 seconds.
Yeah, we got we have 7 second attention spans.
Right.
It's just like boom, we bounce. I'm doing six different things.
Yeah.
We think it's multitasking.
It's not. And again, in this world right now, as competitive as it is for the dollar, and you know, there are a ton of stories out there of how, you know, a driver's, you know, single moment of either expressing gratitude or, you know, ignoring somebody has shifted a sponsorship opportunity. You know, I remember the Advocare story with Trevor Bayne, you know, came about because Trevor was walking across the stage of driver introductions at Atlanta Motor Speedway. It was the Advocare 500. And the president at the time was up on the stage. And as Trevor went through the line, he shook his hand and said, thank you for supporting our sport. We appreciate everything you're doing. He was the only driver that did that.
Wow.
And out of it, he said, hey, let's keep an eye on that kid. And, you know, a partnership developed after that.
Wow. That's awesome. Good story. One of the things that you and I both have done is obviously working both team and on the agency side. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about, this kind of gets tricky a little bit, but let's talk a little bit about that dance between agencies and teams.
Right.
How we work together to create joint value. What, any keys that you've seen in your days, and I'll comment as well, try to add value to this conversation, but any kind of keys just on of how those, I kind of stumbled, not doing a very good job answering the question, but that whole dance of working together.
Yeah and you're right, it is a dance, but I think that the music's changed over the past probably 6-7 years. Right, there was a time when it was sort of the necessary evil, we have to work together. Right. But I represent the brand. If I'm on the agency side, I represent the brand. And what I say is going to go, Mr. Property, Mrs. Property, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it might be. And the teams on the other side were saying, you know, we're the ones who are delivering the asset. We're the ones who are going to protect our brand and, mm-hmm. you know, what we stand for. So we'll tell you, agency, what we're willing to do. And quite honestly, we'd rather you not even be in the conversation. We just want to go direct to the decision makers themselves. I would say in the last, you know, 5 to 7 years, based on how the economic swing took place, properties are more flexible and willing to work because the bottom line is if it's good for the brand, it's good for all of us, agency and property. So let's figure out a way that we can work together. You know, it's almost like they talk about when you make a hot dog, right? No one needs to see how it's made. You just want to see the finished product.
Right.
Right. And that was always our approach on the team side, as well as the agency when I was with the marketing arm, was always, hey, let's hash this out here. The client doesn't need to see this.
Right.
Right. Because all they care about is the product that we end up with, you know, and if it's truly for their benefit, then there's going to be a path. there's got to be a path for us. So I would say the lessons there really is open communication. It's building trust for sure, which can be tough in those relationships, but trust and relationships matter today more than anything.
Yeah. I agree. Well put. I think that the, one of the things that's unique about NASCAR is we all are independent contractors.
Yeah.
So we're all competitors. Mm-hmm. Like on the team side, the track side, NASCAR side,
yeah,
agency side, we all compete, but at the same time, we all work together.
Yeah,
and I think there is more openness to doing that now, and we've seen some good things. I think some with properties, especially with race teams, and race teams may be unique in this. I don't know that you'd have the same conversation with the NFL teams or NBA or whatever, maybe, but it seems like more teams are really spending that time to invest in actually bringing people on for social media. They're bringing people on, maybe a little bit more on the account manager. They're still lean, and the resources still go into competition for sure. But trying to really position themselves, at least pay attention to how do I become the best partner for our sponsor. And I do think establishing a level of trust between the agencies and the properties is key. It comes through time. That comes through.
It absolutely does. And I felt I had a bit of a natural advantage in those conversations, having sat on agency and the brand side when I was with Roush Fenway, because I could say, hey, I've sat in your seat. I understand what you're trying to get to. Let's figure that out. What are those decision filters? What are those triggers that we need to be as a property mindful of, so that we could be proactive in addressing that or finding a way to build out a solution, right? And we found sometimes, though, that some of our partners didn't have an agency. So that's where we really did have to step in and help with the strategy, and it worked very well for us just because it allowed us to align ourselves closer with those brands and more importantly, deliver the results.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Well, hey, man, that's good. Appreciate your insight on NASCAR. But you left the race team in February. Let's talk about what you're doing now. You got some cool stuff in the works. You've kind of moved into this position of brand building and positioning.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about where Mike Mooney is today.
Yeah. It's one of those things, Jim, where there's a moment in time where you think, take a deep breath and you think the time's right to make a change. And then you wake up at 2 a.m. and go, I don't know if this is the right time to make a change or not, right? But the reality is, I've been in sports for 25 years and have loved it. Never had a real job in my entire life, And what I'm doing now is I'm kind of shifting gears over to still working with brands. I'm working with some agencies and groups that are still interested in brand building, telling the story, figuring out how to position themselves in the marketplace, right? In a way that's still going to be, relevant and cost-effective and creative and kind of leverage the things that I've been doing, right? Motorsports just happened to be the vehicle for telling those stories, I'm working with some great people right now on their brands and where we're building out. Also, I have a book that's coming out in about a month that I've been working on for several years, and I'm doing some speaking around that. I'm building out some workshops as well.
Talk about the book. So the book is, you tell us.
Right. Well, I'll start with this. Right. If I asked you right now, this would be your surprise question.
Okay, that's good.
I'm going to turn the tables on you.
I was hoping for free consulting while you're here.
We'll do that. We'll get to that part. If I would ask you right now to put a dollar value on your reputation, how much is that?
I don't know if I could put a dollar value on it, but I would say well over 80% of the value of my work and the work of Marcus Shear Sports, I think, is tied to our reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we talk to people about, are you aware of what we're doing or whatever, it always comes back to, I've heard this about you, I've heard that about you.
Right.
Always seems to be pretty consistent. And it always seems to be things that we're proud of. So
yeah. And I'll usually get several answers to that. One of them being, I believe it's worth X of our current value. Some will say it's priceless, and some will say I never even really thought of it that way, right? But the reality is, we often don't think of the value of a reputation until after we've paid a price, right? So over the years of not only, you know, doing the brand building work, but a lot of that was working in crisis management and dealing with things from driver deaths to sponsor bankruptcies to drivers just doing dumb things, right? And cleaning up the messes. And, you know, it became clear to me that there oftentimes are ways to avoid the issue if we were more proactive. It would just take that step to look at what are the areas of risk and let's address them. Hmm. Let's figure that out. Let's get ahead of it. Because the reality is that, you know, I like to say your reputation speaks for you when you aren't there to speak for yourself, right? And that gets back to your point on your business. 65% of all new business comes through referrals. It's 100% based on your reputation, right? But you don't know the opportunities that you may have even missed if your reputation isn't good.
Right.
You'll never know about it. I mean, when was the last time somebody called you, Jim, and said, hey, I need somebody who can do X, Y, and Z. Do you know about Don? Tell me about Don. Well, if your experience with Don was not positive, well, Don's not even in the consideration set, and he doesn't even know it.
Right.
And how many of those have passed you by over the years? So, Jim, the name of the book is Reputation Shift. And the idea behind it was really about a shift in mindset for people to look at what is truly one of their greatest assets in their business and personal lives in a different way. And obviously with the phrasing and shifting, you know, speaks back to my career and experience in motorsports. And in motorsports, when you shift, it's about moving forward. Right? It's about momentum and progress. So I was trying to tie both of those messages into the title.
Excellent. Talk about some of the things that are in there. One of the things you hit on is the reputation economy. Define that for us.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we're living in it right now, but many folks don't truly look at it that way, right? With technology that we have and the fact that people on average will check 14 different sources before making a purchase, right? The ability for people to really check in on what's being said about you as a leader or a brand, if people are looking to maybe join your organization or if they're looking to buy a product, what are other people saying about it? Unlike any other time in human history, do we have the opportunity and the resources to really check in the way that we can now? So it really is about trust. And that's the basis of this reputation economy. It's trust. So, you know, how are we building that each day, right? What are the threats that could erode that each day? I mean, right now, nearly 90% of marketers say that building trust is one of their greatest priorities over all of the marketing initiatives.
It's key. Good stuff. We'll talk about one of the things that, let's continue on that. When you think about trust, what are some of the keys to being able to do that? And I'm thinking, specifically, I'll put words in your mouth after looking on your website and getting ready for this, obviously.
All right.
I really like the point. You've got some stuff on there about two keys, time and consistency.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That staying with it every day, building on it and being consistent.
Yeah.
But it does take time. This is not a quick fix.
It isn't, you know, in either building or repairing. Because, you know, the reality is that you can repair a reputation. It just takes, again, time and consistency. Just as you want to build one, it takes time and consistency. So, you know, the basis of it gets back to values, right? It's what do we value as individuals, and then how are we living into that each day? Mm. Oftentimes, when you look at reputation crisis among individuals, there is a point in time where you can look back, and I've done this many years, and you sort of dissect, how did we get to this place? And there are times when there was this intersection of values and decisions, and sometimes people stepped away from the values and made a decision that, you know, did not align with that and then caused issues down the line. So, you know, and the consistency also is in three other places in who we are, what we say, and what we do, right? I mean, I'm sure you can think of some people maybe that you've worked with over the years that will say that they're one thing, but when you see their actions or how they interact with people, you're like, whoa, that is not
right.
That isn't, they are like a 180 from what they say or what they're who they're trying to be. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's the consistency, or in that case, inconsistency. And we'll see that, you know, and then again, it's just a matter of time. One of the one of the points in the book that I break out, and from a communications guy to go into math is often a scary thing. But that's
why you have editors.
Right, exactly right. So for me, it was more of a linear approach, and it was this reputation equation that basically it's your values influence your decision. Your decisions drive your behavior. Your behavior consistently over time is what becomes your reputation, right? So you put all those together, and that gives you a better idea of, yeah, you know, it really does come down to values and decisions. Those are the drivers.
Couple of things in looking through the book, I'm happy to let people know I've actually held the book.
It is it is real. It's real.
It is real. And seriously, congratulations on putting a lot of the years and the time and your heart into this thing, and evident that it's that it's there, and it's great to see it come to life for you.
Thank you.
A couple of questions in looking through there, just high level, that I thought were really interesting. One, talk about the bank of you and building into the bank of you. Sure.
So think of it this way: every day when you open your wallet, there are two ATM cards in there. One is for your actual physical bank, right, where you have your money and you're either depositing or withdrawing every day, right? The other is this card for the bank of you, which you're either making deposits or withdrawals every day based upon your interactions, right? The things you say and do, or maybe the things you don't say or the things you don't do that are having an impact on other people. And the idea is that you need to have a strong balance at the bank of you.
Yeah.
Right. You want to make sure you're not withdrawing more than you're depositing, because, again, crisis, reputation, issues, problems, we're human. We have them. Right. It's never a question of if, it's really just a matter of when. So there are going to be times when, you know, you're going to need to make some withdrawals in that account. And if you're zero balance or negative, or you're getting, you know, insufficient funds reports in.
Yeah.
There's no safety net there. That's the beauty of reputation. It can give you a second chance.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we have talked about that. Actually, Kelly and I talk about that in our marriage, and we've had over the years. Right?
Right.
You invest in your marriage. You make sure you got a positive balance, because
there are
going to be times when you make withdrawals, and
probably in the marriage we make more withdrawals.
We're ones who withdraw. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. And but as long as we have a positive bank account. Again, you can recover.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And what are you doing each day to try to make deposits?
Yeah.
Right? The little things, the simple things, going above and beyond, right? In the relationship, in your business, with your teams, right? Where are those little places where you can make those deposits with people? And it's not in the mindset of, oh, I'm going to need this someday, or I'm going to need you to do something. It's because it's the right thing.
Right. Yeah. You do good work. That's right. You keep your clients' best interest in mind. Keeping
Absolutely.
Them first. I mean, it's... are you nose down doing that? And then another one I ask you just real quick too, emotions. So many of us live by emotion, but you talk about moving past the emotions.
Yeah.
On all this. At the end of the day, I assume what you're saying, I can put words in your mouth, but you got to, some days I don't feel like it. Some days my feelings are hurt or whatever, mm-hmm. but you continue to go back to the well and do what's right. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's oftentimes about doing the right thing, like you were saying there. But when you're in the midst of a reputation issue or a crisis or something of that nature, right, it's natural to get emotional. If someone were to say something about your organization or you personally, the natural inclination, right, is to take that and emotionally filter it, and you'll either be angry, you know, terrified, you know, all the range of emotions that you would feel. The idea, though, is, okay, it's fine, feel that, but you got to move past it, because, you know, emotions are not going to get you or your business, your team, whatever it might be, back on track. They're just not, because if you dwell on the emotions, you're going to sit there and miss the opportunity to act. And when there's an issue at hand, time, you never have enough of it. It's not a luxury. You have to act, especially today. You know, years ago, you know, Jim, when we were coming up in the sport and in society before you had Twitter, you know, and other forms of social media, if you didn't react to a crisis situation in 48 hours, that was okay. That was almost standard because, you know, it took time to get it out into the media and get the word going. Today, if you're not responding within 15 minutes, people have already started to make and form their own opinions. So it's really important that you understand, yes, there's an emotional component to it, but you've got to move past it. You know, the story I use in the book was actually when Dale Earnhardt Sr. was killed. And I had this conversation with Jim Hunter, who at the time was running NASCAR Communications, and Jody Powell, who was a heavyweight out of Washington, D.C., was press secretary for Jimmy Carter back during his term. And we were in the Daytona garage several years after the Earnhardt death, and we were talking about how that unfolded. And they're telling me this story about this meeting down in Daytona, and Bill France Jr. was holding it. A lot of senior executives were down there, and he was upset. He was very emotional. Not only had he lost a good friend, but the media fans were attacking the sport. You know, clearly it's something that he was very passionate and loved. And during this meeting, he was talking, and he was very visibly upset about it and angry about what was going on, and wanted to figure out what are we going to do. And at one point, he stopped, and there was like dead silence. And Jody, the way he tells the story was great. He said there was this dead silence in there, people looking at ceiling tiles, people looking at their shoes. And he said, I spoke up and said, with all due respect, Mr. France, being pissed off isn't a strategy. And at that point, Bill Jr. said, you're right. So what are we going to do? And then they moved to action. Right. So it's just a good example of, yes, you can be emotional, you can be upset about it, but you've got to move to action.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, man, I'm excited for you.
Thank you.
I'm excited for the book. I'm excited what you're doing now, the transition, taking that step. And so good stuff. I'll leave.
Thanks, Jim.
I'll add one thing to it. Proverbs 22:1 says, a good name is more desirable than great riches. And I think that is speaks to the importance of what you're working on and helping people figure that piece out. So the book is Reputation Shift, delivers practical strategies for how to build and protect your reputation to ensure personal and professional growth and success. His name is Mike Mooney. Mike, where can they get a hold of you?
Well, you can get me at mikemooney.com. Easy enough. Email is mike@mikemooney.com.
M-O-O-N-E-Y. That's branding.
I'm trying to make it easy. I'm trying. I've learned a thing or two over the years, just trying to make it easy. But thank you for having me on. This is great, and I love what you're doing here as well. This is going to be a great channel for people to share ideas and for folks in the industry and beyond to learn. So thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
This has been the Market Share Sports Podcast, dedicated to helping brands maximize their sponsorships and create more engaging experiences. Visit us at marketsharesports.com to learn more about our work, catch up on past episodes, and sign up for our newsletter. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for joining us.